This is the student broadcast, home and away on 2SER 107.3. I'm Seth Jarnoff, and it is currently 8 a.m. on a relaxing Sunday morning, and I'm here for the next hour. You know, I woke up today feeling like today's going to be a good day, and so far, I seem to be correct. So, you know, I want this amazing feeling to never stop, and this show is going to keep that mood high, that's for sure. I can guarantee you that. As this is the Home and Away show, in the next hour, I will be sharing some brilliant reports on the wonderful Australian wildlife that myself and my team have put together. Also, stay tuned for our current affairs reports from Lucy and Alex. You don't want to miss those. And I will also be sharing the best must-go-to places to visit once our international borders open and we are able to be human again. So keep listening for that. But right now, to keep our spirits high, let's kick off with Australia's very own Emil and the Sniffers with Hurts. That was Emil and the Sniffers with Hurts on 2SER 107.3 with Seth Jarloff. That song is like sculling 5 Red Bulls and then going out for coffee with your friends. It's just a caffeine overload. It's a very energetic start to the day, but you know what? I'm loving it. It feels so good to be able to have this energy and, you know, it'll feel right in the moment. I think it's because I'm allowed out and I'm allowed to see people. You know, I think seeing people and being out in nature has made me just a lot happier. And it's quite refreshing, I feel. I mean, I feel like it's quite refreshing. Speaking of nature, living amongst nature can be both enjoyable and difficult. Right now, I've got Tiff Gardner and Darcy Cox talking about Australian at-home wildlife and how to coexist with them. Bush care volunteer Rodney Cox and terrestrial ecologist Dr. John Martin will also provide their input on why coexistence is so important and how to ethically deal with Australian pests. Get your pen and pad ready, as you don't want to miss these Aussie backyard remedies. Just a quick disclaimer, this feature does contain some slight, very slight profanity, so I would keep that in mind if there are kids listening. Thank you.
I'm Darcy Cox. I have Rodney Cox joining me, who is my dad. Rod is a Northern Beaches bush care volunteer, and he's been involved for just under a year. Being a bush care volunteer basically means you need to know and understand your local flora and fauna. Today, I have one in mind. You might know this one already. Blackbird, red throat, likes to make mounds.
Hi everyone, it's a pleasure to be asked to be on air today to talk to you about bush turkeys, as I believe they're just misinterpreted pests. First, I have to talk about their funny mannerisms and why they do what they do.
Okay, take it away. I have currently 5 bush turkeys in my backyard that never cease to be creating large mounds and defecating on my best friends. So if there's a deterrent, I'm all ears.
Well, bush turkeys are so unique. They are born from a mound first and must wriggle their way up to the surface. From the moment they're born, they can fly and are independent animals. The birth process of laying an egg in a mound and abandoning them is seen as incredibly primitive nesting behaviour, akin to crocodile's egg's incubation process.
Are the mounds treated like a house? The bigger, the more intricate, the more chance of mating?
Generally, bush turkeys are always trying to gather sticks to create bigger and better mounds and gain attention.
So basically, I bought this new house on the northern beaches with my boyfriend, and the house is all I could have ever wished for. But if you want to walk to the back of the property, all you can see is mounds beginning to form and 2 smug arseholes. We recently planted some native plants in the backyard, and then 2 days later, I found them dug out and on multiple mounds. How do I stop the bush turkeys from making mounds and ruining my gorgeous backyard?
Bush care has taught me a lot on the preventative measures that can be made to save your garden. Whenever the bush care volunteers and I plant a new native plant, we put 2 wooden stakes next to them, as bush turkeys are a bit stupid and will not touch them if surrounded by something they don't know. For the mounds in my backyard, I've laid out chicken wire on the ground and planted on top to help keep it secure. This will help reduce the number of debris that the bush turkeys can pick up. Just keep an eye on it as they slowly figure it out. I've also heard of another unorthodox preventative measure that revolves around leaving soft toys in random places around your garden, because they are petrified of anything new.
Thank you, Rod. That's all we have time for today. Next is Tiff, who will be talking to a research scientist who specializes in conservation.
Dr. John Martin, research scientist, Taronga Conservation Society, Australia. I research how animals are adapting to live with humans. One of the species I do study is the Australian brush turkey.
I've had quite a number of them over the years. I've named all of them Ivan. Even when there's more than one at the same time, they're all Ivan.
Great name.
Grown quite fond of him, but I would like it if he didn't keep digging up my native plants that I put down.
They're certainly good at multipliers. I'm not sure if I'd call that gardening, because they don't really grow things. They're pretty good at destroying gardens. You've got males who are chasing some chickens around people's backyards because they, for all intents and purposes, are looking for love in the wrong place.
Bush turkeys are the most ancient member of a family that dates back 30 million years. This includes chickens, quails, peacocks, pheasants. Bush turkeys are dinosaurs.
All birds are dinosaurs. It's an interesting space where we're learning more about the evolution of birds and dinosaurs and the connection between these groups of animals. So birds are ultimately modern dinosaurs. The 10,000 odd species of birds around the world are quite literally modern dinosaurs. So the nesting method of brush turkeys, building a nest mound and having the vegetation that's decomposing and the heat that generates incubating the eggs, that's a prehistoric nesting methodology. And so there's about 10,000 different bird species and less than 50 of them actually use that methodology. But that's a method that we see some other prehistoric species use. Another living example is the crocodile. But of course they aren't dinosaurs, they're a whole separate lineage. But some dinosaurs potentially use that nesting methodology as well.
Is there anything we the public can do for the bush turkeys?
We're starting to see chicks hatching in the Sydney region, and We have a citizen science project called Big City Birds, where we ask people to report their sightings of brush turkeys, so whether they've got wing tags, so we can learn about individual birds, like Ivan, for example, or if different behaviours like nesting and what they're eating. And so, yeah, we just encourage everyone to report sightings. You can use the app or the website, Big City Birds. So much is going on that you maybe don't realise. You've got to watch your brush turkeys. They're really interesting.
This is the 2SCR Student Broadcast 107.3 with me, Seth Jarloff, and that was Darcy and Tiff's report on bush turkeys. You know, I was never really a massive fan of the bush turkey. Like, I'm pretty sure they taste good in a sandwich, but other than that, I wasn't really convinced. The thing is with these birds, they've been around for about 30 million years. They're walking fossils, and all I thought was that they dig up holes in the ground and flick leaves on the road, but thank you to Tiff and Darcy for changing my perspective, because let's be honest, they're frankly an important part of Australian culture. Coming up soon, we'll be hearing from Lucy on her report on children returning back to school and more features on a beautiful Australian wildlife. That's up next on 2SER. That was Darcs LTD Fit to Burst on 2SCR 107.3, the current time being pretty much quarter past 8. Now, we as Australians have been battling a rough lockdown for a few months, and it's been rough for all of us, especially our teachers and our students. But as all Sydneysiders know, all our children return to school this week. The children no doubt were buzzing to be back in the classroom with our teachers now able to sufficiently teach. And most importantly of all, those parents will finally have some quiet. I mean, they probably still have to go to work, but, you know, they'll have more quiet than usual. Here's our reporter, Lucy Taylor, to tell us more.
Good morning, Seth. There's no doubt that Sydney families are full of excitement this past week, with all students finally returning to face-to-face learning. It's been a long time coming. Children have finally seen their friends again, running around in the playground. Parents are finally getting some quiet time at home. We're all looking at the benefits of life slowly starting to return to normal. But what should we be concerned about?
What are you most looking forward to about going back to school?
Just mainly seeing my friends and seeing my teacher and just doing work properly.
I'm not really excited about anything. School's normally boring.
Are you excited to see your friends?
Yes.
Are you concerned about anything going back to school with COVID still around?
Well, a little bit, but I mean, I just want to go back. I mean, homeschooling sucks.
No, not really.
Will is at high school and he's fully vaccinated now, so I feel a bit more comfortable about him being back at school, being vaccinated. I guess going on public transport is still a bit of a worry for me, figuring out how we're going to get him to school without going on public transport.
I recently spoke to Janet Purdy, a secretary at St. Michael's Primary School in Manchester, UK. By speaking to Janet, we travel forward in time as schools have been face-to-face for a few months now.
Only a small primary school. We've got 207 children when everybody's in.
Oh, wow.
And I deal with the day-to-day running of the school and all the finances.
So you were quite busy when you were obviously preparing to go back face-to-face learning then?
Yeah, well, I've never been off in the whole time of the lockdown from when it began.
Janet's small primary school has been largely successful at staying operational as the restrictions have lifted and COVID can pass more quickly through the community. Janet was kind enough to share some of the measures that the school have put in place to keep the environment safe during these tough times.
At break time, well, we had staggered break times, so that they weren't all in the playground at the same time. We also had staggered arrival times, so that each class came at a different time. All the children had their meals in the classrooms. The teachers and the teaching assistants went to the kitchen to collect the meals to take them to the children in the classroom, so that they was always separated. The younger children did go in the dining room for lunch, but one class at a time so that there wasn't mixing. Nobody was allowed in the office. Parents were not allowed in school. If they wanted contact, they either had to phone or email.
Janet's school has thought out an abundance of strategies to reduce the spread of COVID in schools. So, what happens when there is a positive case? If we're learning to live with COVID, do we ignore it? Or will it continue to have a negative impact on education by constantly switching to home learning?
When the children did come back, we started off by, if there was an outbreak in that class, then we would just close that class, not every class.
Yeah.
And then they had to isolate for 10 days. That doesn't happen now.
Okay.
If a child tests positive at school, just that child has to isolate, nobody else does anymore, unless you've got symptoms, then you go for a test. I've got some friends that work in a secondary school. I think it's been a bigger problem there. Their rate was higher of students being off. You know, their attendance wasn't as good as ours.
Concerns for the children returning to school whilst living with COVID is at an all-time high. What about concerns for the staff? How will staff be impacted whilst the children are returning to school?
Well, the problem was that many of our staff have got children at secondary school. They tested positive. Then back in July, the whole household had to isolate for 10 days. So we did have staffing issues then.
Lastly, I asked for Janet's advice on what initiatives does she recommend Australia do as we start to reopen schools in a world of COVID.
Just try and keep it as isolated as you can. I don't recommend that parents come in. Go to the school if you need to, i.e. drop your child off, then go immediately.
Returning to our present time, schools have been open for a week now. Many concerned parents are probably wondering what COVID preventative measures have been put in place in our schools. Have hands been washed enough? Do kids really social distance in the playground? After listening to Janet, I wonder, will Sydney schools be as successful living with COVID as Janet's school has?
You're listening to 2SER 107.3, FM, DAB, on demand, live stream, and app.
Yeah.
commands. Please take us to your leader and we'll listen.
We are back. Thank you, Lucy, for that brilliant report. It is so good to see our children returning back, working hard, and being able to be amongst their friends, which I think is the most important thing for them, that social interaction. You know, social interaction has been one of the most dearly missed aspects of life. But now you go out in the city and you see everything. You see it all. You see the hustle and bustle of busy workers, picnics that rose in popularity, people having a good time, and of course, the coexistence of people and Australia's wildlife. Even in the city, our wildlife is everywhere. Like, it is known that Australia houses some of the greatest flora and fauna in the world. And the main man, David Attenborough, has been showcasing our wildlife in countless documentaries, which I have been binging during lockdown. We've also had the brilliant Irwin family showing off those cracking crocs, legendary lizards, and some of the most beautiful birds we've got to offer. But there is one iconic Australian animal that is shunned away from the limelight, an animal so hated that few people even call it by its actual name. 2SER reporter Lachlan Acord and myself, that's right, I did some reporting, tried to find out more. Now, just a quick warning, this feature also contains slight profanity quite early on, so just keep that in mind if there are kids listening. Thank you.
What is your favourite Australian animal?
I am pretty fond of the kookaburra. It's good, it's got the laugh, what more can you want?
Probably a wombat?
A koala.
It used to be the numbat. I'm not sure if it's changed.
What about the ibis? Have you considered them?
They're annoying as fuck.
Yeah, I don't think it would be on my favourite animals list.
If my favourite bird was a 10 and my least favourite bird was a 0, I'd give the ibis around a 0 to a 1. I'm not a big fan of it at all.
I hate ibises.
How did it come to this? What went wrong? How could we have turned our backs on one of our own?
The ibis is an emblem of Australia, a native animal known by everybody, and yet almost nobody has a nice thing to say about them.
To learn more about this iconic bird, we spoke to Dr. John Martin from the Taronga Conservation Society.
When we wind back the clock, we're talking about the 1950s, 60s, 70s, ibis were a pretty uncommon species in urban areas. That's changed quite a lot in the decades subsequently. Over the 20th century, we've changed our land use practices and we've altered, therefore, the nesting and foraging habitat available for white ibis in their natural habitats. So the ibis is a really interesting species in that it has shifted its behavior and adapted to tolerate the presence of humans and tolerate our built landscapes and to scavenge on foods that were completely novel to them.
The ibis has almost become an attraction in itself, with thousands living in major cities, mixing with tourists and locals.
We have forced them out of their natural areas. We've decreased the availability of that habitat. In response to that, they've been pretty phenomenal in showing their, the biological term we use is plasticity. So they have adaptive behaviours.
So why is there so much hate for a bird that has nowhere else to go? Retired ecologist Greg Clancy helped shed some light.
Oh, I think they probably see them as a bit of a nuisance. They've sort of taken over from the silver gulls scavenging around cafes and people having fish and chips and things like that. And of course, they're now called the bin chicken, where they get into rubbish bins. And so I think people generally who don't understand the ibis, I think they do have a negative view of them.
Despite being a menace at a picnic, ibises are actually quite helpful. As a wetland bird, they naturally feed on bugs and insects that might otherwise be harmful to our plants. When they aren't digging through bins, ibises are keeping our ecosystems safe.
If you've ever been down to a wetland and you're watching an ibis walking through the water with their long legs, you can see that they've evolved to have those legs to actually have that exact behaviour. You can then see that they've got that long neck and their long bill and they're probing into the water column. And again, you're like, ah, I see. This is why this bird is this shape and this size. It has these natural behaviours that stem from those physical attributes. They just happen to lend themselves quite well to probing into bins and landfills and things like that.
But not even that seems to have redeemed their image to the public.
When I think of an ibis, the first words that come to my head are bin chicken, trash, Sydney, dirty, bird. That's about it.
You know, they're known for being a bin chicken. Who else in the world can say there's a bird called a bin chicken?
And sometimes people wear shirts with ibises on them, and it bothers me.
Even without the bin tactics, they're quite scary. Like, I've always been a bit afraid of the ibis, even though I don't think it would actually go out of its way to harm me. It seems pretty chill, but, like, its beak is just terrifying.
This isn't us, Australia. I'm ashamed that we have acted with such hostility towards the greatest Aussie battler to ever exist.
So what can we do? How do we promote a more positive image of the ibis?
Well, this is a national crisis, and in times of crisis, I look to our leaders for inspiration. Let's make an ad.
Introducing the ibis.
But this time, spelt with a lowercase I and a capital B.
The groundbreaking and innovative bird that's taking the Australian public by storm.
Not only do they protect native plants, but they keep our streets safe from litter.
With a sleek design, subtle colouring, and a beak perfect for reaching through nooks and crannies,
it's being described as Australia's answer to the flamingo.
Coming to a rubbish bin near you.
You're listening to 2SER 107.3 FM DAB, on demand, live stream, and app.
That was Lachlan and myself, reporter Seth, on the true beauty and brilliance of the ibis. A hugely underrated bird, if I do say so myself. Like, when I first moved to Sydney from England back in 2016, you know, I went to the Harbour Bridge and the Opera House and did all those touristy things, and I was terrified of these birds. Absolutely petrified. They just kept eyeing my food, and I was like, no, I paid for this. Well, my mum paid for this food, and I'm going to eat it. You can't have it. Sorry. And those beaks. Wow. Like, I was trembling in my boots, genuinely. But as myself and Lachlan showed, they can be very helpful to our crops, as well as incredibly smart. Like, their adaptability to live amongst us, like, in our city, is second to none, in my opinion. So remember the ibis, the bird with a lowercase I and a capital B, the new and improved bird of Australia. Now, coming up soon, I give you the best must-go-to places after our international borders open, as well as more current affairs from Alex Driscoll. That's up soon on 2SER 107.3.
Oh,
That was My Baby Don't by the Shivas. It is 2SER 107.3 student broadcast. It is currently 8:35 a.m. and you're still with Seth Jailath. Alright, this is my time to shine. This is where I'm going to plan out your future holidays. I've got a few must-go-to holiday destinations when our international borders open. Alright, number one. Is Bali or Indonesia? Now, Bali has been forever a very, very popular destination for Australians who want to have a tropical relaxation and just a chill, chill time. Bali is very much worth the money that you pay. Stunning resorts, exquisite food, and honestly the beaches and just the culture there. Oh, it's something you just have to experience. Honestly, book your tickets as soon as you can because you don't want to miss that opportunity. And try not to book around schoolies time because you will be reminded how old you are and no one wants that, alright? So don't book around schoolies time. Number two. Now, as I said at the start, this is the home and away segment and I've picked an away one, which is Bali. Now I'm going to choose one closer to home and that's Hamilton Island. Hamilton Island up near Queensland is such a beautiful place to go. It's almost an entire private resort filled with so many activities from bars, snorkeling, chilling out on the beach, getting your tan on, or even just driving around in golf buggies, because why not? Like, it's such it's the peak of relaxation, and no matter how long you stay, you are guaranteed to have a good time. Look into it. I say maybe book sooner rather than later, because prices can be quite steep at peak time, but get your butt to Hamilton Island. And number three, we're back away, and it's got to be Singapore. Singapore is my wild card. I really think it's the place to go. The nightlife is amazing. It's close by as well. And the food, oh my god, the food. It will transport you into a state where you just feel like you're on top of the world. You could have the food in Singapore, call up your boss and tell them, nah, that's it, I'm staying here, because the food is that good. Like I said, it's close by as well, definitely worth the money, and like, it's a rich place, with so many incredible things to do. They've got Universal Studios, go see that amazing boat hotel, which just looks cool, and even the airport itself is amazing, just stay at the airport if you want to. Like, I remember when I was about 8 or 9, I was in Singapore, and I was walking in the street, and there was a big concrete block on the path, and as a young delinquent, I wanted to jump over it, and basically, I fell into an open drain. I was able to hold onto the edge and people helped me up, but don't let my stupidity turn you off Singapore. Don't let my stupidity turn you off Singapore. Go see it. It's honestly amazing. And number four, finally, it's a bit of a cheap one, but I genuinely think this is probably one of the best ones. I would say go see as much family and friends as possible. Life has been so difficult for all of us, and there is nothing better than being able to see your family, see your friends, see anyone who means anything to you. Heck, see the person that annoys you just to, like, bring some life, I don't know, rejuvenate your brain or something. Go see anyone. You know, we've all been through this together. So it's time to see those who mean the most to you and enjoy that moment. Travel to see your friends and family and make the most out of it. And there we go. That's simple. Those are the best travel destinations you have to go to. Keep them in mind. Do your research. And when you have the best of time, you can go, gosh, I'm so glad I listened to Seth Jailath on 2SCR 107.3 at 8 a.m. on a Sunday morning. All right. Okay, up next we have Alex Driscoll's Current Affairs, and soon we will also hear from Alex and Lucy on their report on Sydney and wildlife. This is Seth Jailath on 2SCR 107.3.
Mothers, being strong wives. He brought me in this world, brought me all of your milk. From your nurma I drank. No brother could do no brother's brother. There's a sisterhood of mothers, a genderhood of girls. Soon to become women in this place of the birth. Ain't no woman gonna get left behind. Ain't no woman gonna get left behind. Ain't no woman
patriarch and a royal family. I'd make a black crown, place it on you. That's from me and my kids. There's a magic and a healing that you naturally give, and a medicine of love that's been passed for us to live. There's no woman gonna get left behind, and no woman gonna get left behind. There's no woman gonna get left behind, and no woman gonna get left behind. There's no woman gonna get left behind, and no woman gonna get left behind.
Was No Woman Left Behind by Emma Donovan on the Home and Away student broadcast 2SCR 107.3. Now, we've heard a lot of brilliant music this show. It's been fantastic. And everyone knows the Australian indie music scene is one of the biggest in the world. I'm saying it again. We have some of the best. And we're going to move on to something quite relevant to do with that. In the space of 2 weeks, Australian indie rock band Rancid Eddie went from breakout stars to relative obscurity again, in part thanks to some incredibly sexist lyrical material. This begs the question, how accountable are we holding our local indie musicians? Alex Driscoll wanted to find out and went about investigating the level of accountability in indie music, as well as seeing if it should be greater or lesser than it already is. Another quick warning, there is some sensitive language in this report, so once again, if there are kids listening, I would keep that in mind. Take it away, Alex.
What you're hearing there is derived by Australian indie rock band Rancid Eddie. With over 4 million streams, the unsigned Melbourne locals have had an impressive month, and things only got better. It seemed like Rancid Eddie was on top of the world in early October, being promoted by Triple J and Spotify. The Australian indie rocker's new track seemed like the song of the summer for many. Propelled by TikTok virality, the group had the ears of the Australian public. However, just as quickly as they shot to fame, they found themselves in hot water. Videos emerged of some of the band's social media history, documenting songs filled with some sexist and harmful language. These videos, to many, revealed to the world a group of young men who struggled with their views on women, and the band soon totally disappeared off the airwaves. Though there is a small, almost entirely male movement on social media in the band's defence, it seems like their day in the sun is over. In a day and age where such treatment of women in media is becoming less and less tolerated, how touched is the Australian indie rock scene by these growing concerns? And is bad behaviour being held accountable?
I'm in a band called Over Orion, and we have released one single a while.
That's back. Musician Max Van Spiker, who has a number of projects floating around the local scene here in Sydney. Like many other Australian artists, he has watched the Rancid Eddie situation with interest.
As a musician, it's weird because I'm kind of, it's a bit torn between like freedom and artistic expression and like being a decent person, you know, like you have the freedom to write whatever you want. And I think it's kind of a bit torn between like what I think is right and what I like feel that people should write about, not should write about, but like is okay for people to write about and people's freedom to write whatever they like. Like, I don't want to be like, you can only write songs about love songs. You only write songs about, I don't know, like, going on a drive on the highway, like, you know, like it's a bit torn between like the freedom of writing and like the morals of what you should write about and the language you use when you are writing them.
Scandals like these sometimes feel few and far between in the Australian music industry. So is there an actual problem of a lack of accountability, or is there no problem at all?
I think is definitely a loud minority of what, like, I think vastly, like, I can name 10 bands right now that I have no problem playing their music for. I can play probably no more than that. Like, I think there's a loud minority of really bad behavior, and I think that can give a bad name to the rest of the group that's actually doing, like, not doing anything wrong. I think there definitely are some, especially in, like, all male bands, there's a tendency to have some misogynistic views.
Many other music scenes around the world have had to live with the consequences of the egregious actions of some artists and people in power. A particularly horrific one was the Burning Sun scandal in the South Korean K-pop scene. Here's Macquarie University's Dr. Sarah Keith to explain it.
It was basically a scandal which centered on exploitation of women in various ways. Part of it was to do with a social scandal that was a big issue in Korea at the time, which was a kind of hidden camera scandal where women were often filmed in sexual or compromising positions without their consent, and the footage was distributed online and often used for blackmail.
Do you think something like this could happen in the Australian music scene?
Well, I think it's quite difficult to compare the K-pop music industry and Australia's music industry. I mean, we don't really have mega stars within Australia in the same way that the K-pop industry has these really dominant global entertainment figures. But it certainly wouldn't be surprising if Dennis Handlin was not the only person who had problematic behavior.
The Burning Sun scandal and the allegations leveled at Sony Music's Dennis Handlin are far more extreme examples of bad behavior going unchecked and then being held accountable for than what happened with Rancid Eddie. Consumers also have a lot of power in exercising accountability, and Rancid Eddie's fall from grace is a good example of this being put into use.
And I think ultimately it's up to individuals to decide whether they want to continue supporting an artist who has views that they find objectionable.
And whilst this example might offer us a rare glimpse into the issues that plague Australia's indie music scene, it is still hard to grasp just how deep they might go and how much needs to be done in order to create an inclusive, safe environment where all people, especially women, do not feel like they're being marginalised and harassed, and where the bad behaviour of powerful and influential figures is held accountable before it's too late.
Thank you, Alex, for that genuinely insightful report. It is so interesting to see the types of behaviour in the indie music industry, and it is absolutely vital to hold those accountable for such behaviour, no matter what. It has no place in our industry, it has no place anywhere for that matter. It is currently 10 to 9 in the morning on 2SER 107.3 with Seth Jarlath. And in the past hour, we've been talking about different places to go, kids returning to school, and bad behaviour in the music industry. But our main topic has been about our Australian animals and our coexistence with them in the bustling city of Sydney. Up now, we have our final report, and this is one for our animal lovers. You've all seen the high-rise buildings continually popping up around Sydney. But how has this impacted Australian wildlife? Are they okay? Here's Lucy Taylor and Alex Driscoll debating the question, how has Australian wildlife adapted to urban environment?
Sydney, a global city. When not locked down, its hustle and bustle is constant. With a population of 5.3 million and covering an area of roughly 12,000 kilometres squared, its size is immense.
I'm Lucy Taylor.
And I'm Alex Driscoll.
And today we're going to be discussing how Australian wildlife has adapted to these vast urban environments.
The city of Sydney is one still surrounded by trees and wildlife, particularly in the northern outskirts. However, as our population grows and we push further and further into these wildernesses, the hustle and bustle of Sydney suburban life has made its way there too. only 4.5% of bushland remains in the North Sydney area due to the ever-increasing suburban sprawl. This means a lot of our unique native wildlife have not only become icons, but neighbours.
It's crazy to think that where we are sitting now used to be home to all these Australian animals. Imagine kangaroos bouncing around, koalas sleeping in the trees, and plenty of other iconic Australian animals that we may have never even seen, just living out their daily lives right where we stand.
But there's one Australian treasure that often isn't mentioned and has been struggling since our immense urban explosion, the humble platypus.
I, like many Sydneysiders, have never seen a platypus in the wild. Imagine spotting a platypus taking a dip in the pool in the back garden, or in your local national park. For such a famous animal, they appear to be so elusive.
Apparently there are still a couple of platypuses roaming our local area. I actually recently spoke to Danielle from Chen, who works in the conservation of the platypus in the Cadi area.
It's a flagship species, so seeing that platypus are declining and are struggling really gives us an indication of where our waterways are at and that our waterways need help. So if platypus are struggling, that may mean also that their food source is struggling. And why is that? Maybe because the water health isn't so great. So it's just showing us that they're a flagship species and showing us that if platypus are in trouble, then our aquatic ecosystems are in trouble.
The elusive nature of the platypus means that even skilled and dedicated conservationists might not see them in the wild. So how do we know that they are actually present in local Sydney areas?
This is our second year of doing a round of eDNA sampling. So eDNA is a technique. It's quite a new technique. It's environmental DNA. So it's capturing traces of little bits of DNA that platypus leave behind in their waterways. So it could be traces of their hair or their skin or feces.
We know that the platypus is one of the iconic Australian animals that's rarely seen in the day in the life of the Australian people. What other country in the world has a mammal that lays eggs, is entirely aquatic, has a bill for a mouth, and is complete with a venomous spike? So what about the Australian animals that are constantly present in our everyday life? One that might appear to many Sydney residents is the eastern water dragon. There are plenty of people working to protect them in my local area, as I live near the Lane Cove National Park. In fact, the conservation of water dragons is a big thing, especially if residing near a national park. It offers an escape from suburban life.
As someone who immigrated to Australia from the United Kingdom, the water dragon wasn't an Australian animal on my bucket list of animals to see. I've lived here over 10 years, and I can say for certain I've seen a water dragon almost every day. I even have a water dragon at our house who I think might be a little lonely. It's constantly on my veranda, knocking on the window and playing with its reflection. This all got me thinking, what do my neighbours think of water dragons, and what are some of their experiences?
So how do you interact with a water dragon when you come across one?
Oh, I just sort of look at it, and then, well, if I'm trying to get somewhere, I just walk past it.
Well, actually, when I come across them, they're so still when you walk by, it makes me do just the same, so I just freeze too.
And have you had any interesting interactions with a water dragon?
Yes, once we accidentally left the front door open and it sat on the sofa and we had to get it out.
I remember going to the pool and there was a water dragon in the swimming pool.
If you saw a water dragon in your garden, why would you think they are there?
And my little boy would think they're there because it likes us and it's part of our family, but I think it's there because we've got lots of bushes and foliage for it to live in.
Because there's lots of water around and it's just sort of a place that they want to go and chill.
It is important to remember, however, some of the key differences between these two animals that have led to their adaptability. Your average Australian water dragon lays 8 to 16 eggs per clutch, whilst the platypus only lays between 1 to 3.
There are small steps that you, as an individual, can take to ensure that you minimise your impact on the platypus.
Even if you don't live right on one of these creeks and you live quite far out, you can still help by being conscious of your litter. So litter is a big threat to platypus as well, so making sure you dispose of the litter appropriately.
And if any properties want assistance on how to make their place more wildlife friendly, you can reach out to Chen or the Hawkesbury Nepean Landcare Coordinator via the Landcare New South Wales website. That way we can continue to build a city that not only benefits us, but also our iconic, unique and sometimes struggling animal neighbours.
2SER 107.3 FM, DAB, on demand, live stream, and app.
Thank you, Lucy and Alex, for that report. It is great to see how much we care about our animals and how much we need to care to ensure that they stay around for as long as possible, because frankly, we have the best flora and fauna in the entire world. That's it. I've said it. We have the best. We are number one. Don't argue with me. All right. Sorry, I'm getting a little carried away there, all these animal talk. We have come to the end of the hour. It has been a pleasure to be here on this relaxing Sunday morning. I will leave you with Point and Kill by Little Sims. I've been Seth Jarlath on 2SER 107.3. Goodbye. I do what I want, I do what I like, I know what to face, I no fear nobody, nobody. I do what I want, I do what I like, I know what to face, I no fear nobody, nobody. Point and kill, if I want it, it's mine, you can't stop me, hey. Family no go so far. Be fine doing proper, no lie, give me strength, let me prosper. Daddy say you want me to be lawyer, be doctor, riffraff, kiddie gun, window shopper. Oh yeah, fine boy, take away auntie, bougie, ile, oh I fancy when I see a type. Point and kill, if I want it, it's mine, you can't stop me, hey, you can't stop me, oh, you can't stop me. Point and kill, you can't stop me, oh.
You're listening to 2SER 107.3 FM, DAB, on demand, live stream, and app.
Hey, did you forget to subscribe during Radiothon?
Well, today is your lucky day.
If you subscribe to 2SER before the end of October, you can still go into the draw for our major prizes
and still receive all the benefits and freebies our subscribers enjoy.
Join the 2SER family before October 31 by subscribing at 2SER.com now.
The city is coming back. The movies are coming back. And best of all, you're coming back. So bring your gasps, bring your laughter, and bring your biggest big screen crushing. Because movies aren't movies unless we're at the movies together. Sydney Film Festival. Back in theatres, back together. November 3 to 14 in cinema and November 12 to 21 on demand. Explore the program and book tickets at sff.org.au. 2SER sponsors.